seated. Court is ready to hear argument in 050372 El Paso Hospital District versus Texas Health and Human Services Commission.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Marie Yates, and I represent 14 hospitals in Texas that provide Medicaid services. The issue here this morning, Your Honor, is whether the manner in which the state agency...
How many hospitals are there?
There are 350 hospitals in Texas that provide Medicaid services.
And how come only 14 don't like them?
We are 14. There are several others, but we are 14 that recognized this problem and elected to appeal to the agency and complain about it. And when we didn't get relief from the agency, we filed a declaratory judgment action, and it brings me here.
But, I mean, what is there about... I'm looking through the list here of...
These particular hospitals.
These particular hospitals, trying to figure out what El Campo and East Houston...
They happen to be a group of hospitals, Your Honor, that are all relatedly owned. And so when the issue was recognized, these related hospitals all filed appeals and all filed the DJ action, declaratory judgment. So the issue is whether the agency, which is responsible for the reimbursement for Medicaid to the hospitals, in interpreting and applying its base year rule, and that's what we have on the board here, the base year rule, whether in interpreting and applying that, we say erroneously, the agency is violating its statutory mandate. And the statutory mandate, Your Honors, we put in a tab one of our poster booklet. The statutory mandate is that the agency is to adopt rules to assure that the payment rates are reasonable and adequate to meet the cost incurred by the hospital. So the agency decides what rules to adopt. And we say the agency then has to follow its own rules, because if they're not following the rules they adopt, then we have no assurance that they have reasonable and adequate rates to meet our costs. That this is the mechanism that the legislature assumes and the agency assumes will get us to reasonable and adequate reimbursement, and they're not following their own rules. That's what we're complaining about today, Your Honor. And here's why they're not following their own rules. The base year definition, and I'm at tab 2 of the poster booklet, calls for them, in deciding what the prospective reimbursement rate is going to be, to use a 12 consecutive month period of claims data. 12 consecutive month period. But they say, and this is at page 26 of their brief to this court, they say, okay, we could have used 12 consecutive months of paid claims, but we elected instead to use 12 consecutive months of admissions to the hospitals. So claims related to 12 consecutive months of admissions to the hospitals is what the agency decided to use. That's supposed to be the 12 consecutive months of claims data. But what's undisputed on this record is that they're not using 12 consecutive months of claims data. It's undisputed on this record that 3 to 5% of the claims, of the admissions, and the claims that relate to those admissions don't get taken into account, because in addition to this base year rule, they have overlaid on the rule something that's not written in their rules. They have internally overlaid on the rule another requirement that in addition to these 12 consecutive months of admitted claims, those claims not only have to be admitted in those 12 months, but they have to be paid by the February 28th cutoff after the base year. And the result of that, and again, everything I've said so far is undisputed, the result of that is we get what we like to call Swiss cheese. The base year ends up with holes in it because claims, those are the 3 to 5% of claims that get left out. And importantly, it's also undisputed that because the big dollar claims take longer to get processed and paid, they tend to be the ones that get left out. So we have 3 to 5% of the claims get left out. Those are predominantly the large dollar claims. And here is what I think is most important. Mr. Reasonover, who was their principal witness at trial, and his title is Manager of Hospital Rate Analysis. So he is the big cheese in terms of the agency's rate analysis. And he testifies twice in the record, and cited in our brief, that the overall effect of leaving out these big dollar claims, the overall effect of leaving out big dollar claims, is to decrease the standard dollar amount that determines our reimbursement rate. It decreases the standard dollar amount. It makes sense when
It makes good business sense on their part, but is there ever a period when those claims are factored in to this formula?
No, sir, there's not, Judge Medina, and that's the problem. Once those claims that are represented by the holes, once they fall out, they're never picked back up. And Slice, would you give me there's a three-year cycle.
There's not a provision in here like on a tail where you can come back and make claims for those type of large medical expenses?
Your Honor, this is for purposes of setting the prospective reimbursement rate. So you're right, they fall out of the system, and the big claims that are the holes never get put back in for purposes of adjusting the prospective reimbursement rate. So we never get the benefit of those big claims for the prospective reimbursement rate. See, here's how they do it. They have a three-year cycle. This is laid out in their brief. Honestly, Your Honor, their brief is better than mine on this description, okay? There's a three-year cycle for how they do it. The first is the base year, the second is the evaluation year, and then there's an inactive year. And the way they do it is they take the base year, and then they apply the third, the 28th cutoff, and they say, if your claims are paid in the red period, then we'll count them. But if your claims that are represented by the holes in the base year aren't paid in the red period, we're just not going to count them. And, of course, they make their administrative necessity argument. I need to cover that. They say, well, of course, the claims have to be paid, because if they're not paid, then we don't know if they're Medicaid-eligible claims. And I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. My problem is when they say they have to be paid. And the fact that they've elected not to use the base year for the base year 12 consecutive months of paid claims, they could have done that. And then they would have had all paid claims. But they elect to use 12 consecutive months of admissions instead of paid claims. And then they overlay on top of that, but you got to get them paid by the February 28th deadline. And here's the kicker. We have no control over when they process and pay the claim. You see, it's their, and I'm not trying to say they're doing this on purpose, but it's their necessary, if you want to say, delay.
What other reason would they be doing it?
I'm sorry?
What other reason would they be doing?
Well, the testimony is that the big dollar claims are more complex, and therefore they have to go through more reviews. I mean, I'm not saying that the evidence reflects that they're doing this on purpose. I'm just saying that's the effect. That's the effect. And as far as administrative necessity, of course, one thing they could do is they could say we're going to use 12 consecutive months of paid claims. That would get all, that we wouldn't have any holes or be no Swiss cheese. Or they could say, instead of having the new rates effective on September 1, 2001, we'll move that to the end of the inactive year, to the end of the blue year, and then they'd have 18 more months to get the holes taken care of by getting the paid claims paid. They could do that. Or they could do what they do for appeals. For appeals from claims, they allow, this goes to your question, Judge Medina, when claims are appealed, they pick them up later and they add them into the reimbursement rate. But they don't do that for my kind of claims. In fact, they say the claims that just don't make the February 28th cutoff, your claims don't satisfy the appeals rules, and so we're not going to treat them like appeals. But here's how they do appeals. If appeals are completed in the yellow period of the reimbursement year, then that data from the appeals is added in for purposes of the September 1, 2001 rate. Okay, so it comes after the red period, but they get this new data during the yellow period. They add it in the orange period, and it's counted for the new rates. All right, now the next, please find.
Well, let me just ask you real quick. The September 1, 99 date. I just want to make sure I understand.
Right.
That's people admitted to the hospital on that date, and those who come after.
Right. During the green period.
And so that's why there's not a rolling
that's
lag.
Right. That's right. It's every 3 years, and that's why our prospective rate is skewed because of what they're doing, and it never gets altered, as Judge Medina asked. It never gets fixed.
So it won't be somebody who was admitted on August 31st. It's only those admitted on September 1 on.
September 1, 99 through August 30th, 99 would be that base year. Okay. Now, if appeals are not completed during the yellow period, okay, then their rules expressly provide, say they get completed in the blue year, the inactive year, then they pick it up, they pick up that new data, and they add it in for the next prospective year. So see, the agency knows how to keep adding in new data, but they won't do that for our data. And so the reason I say this to the court is not that I'm suggesting that Your Honor should tell the agency this is how you have to do it. I'm only giving these examples to demonstrate that their administrative necessity argument rings hollow, because in other ways they know how to add in new data, and they just aren't doing it for my new data. So that's why I bring this up, so you see that their administrative necessity argument, we believe, shouldn't fly. Now, the claim...
Well, how would you remedy that? You say you do it on claims paid.
Right.
But then that wouldn't give you a prospective view,
well, yes,
which is
yes,
what
Your
they're
Honor.
Hoping to catch.
It would, Your Honor. You could take the base year and take 12 consecutive months of paid claims. It's whatever claims get paid during the base year. And because large dollar claims are getting paid just like small dollar claims, we're going to get... whatever large dollar claims get paid during the base year.
Well, you could game that one too.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You could game that one too. by delaying filing your claims to stack them up.
Well, no, there's a filing deadline. I mean, we have to file. That's what is so interesting.
Well, but I'm sure it runs from when the person is discharged.
Discharge, that's right.
Well, you could just delay the discharge to stack a few expensive extra ones.
I suppose so. We could.
Any rule can be gained.
I take your point. Now, the Court of Appeals writes at page 9 of the opinion that even if the exclusion of these claims leads to a decrease in the reimbursement rate, it doesn't follow that the hospital's right to reasonable and adequate reimbursement has been affected. Well, Your Honor, that can't be true. That can't be true because the state law is, under this statute as applied by the agency, that they adopt the rules to assure that we get to reasonable reimbursement. And if they've adopted this rule and they're not complying with their own rule and the result is the rate goes down, it can't possibly be that that is not affecting our reasonable and adequate reimbursement, that because the assurance for that is that the agency's rule gets us there.
Has there ever been a situation where you've recovered more than you cost?
Your Honor, I'm so glad you asked that because this is where the trial court went off the track. The trial court has a series of findings where it says, let me go through these hospitals and we're going to compare your reimbursement rate, the reimbursement that you actually got in these 3 or 4 years, to your cost reports. Because they're continually looking at the cost reports, what it costs the hospital to perform services, okay? And by the way, they're continually updating that. The record's undisputed on that. They can't update with my information, but they're continually updating the cost reports the agency is. All right, so they look at the cost reports and they compare it to what we got paid in reimbursement, okay? And what the judge concludes, what his findings are, is that for so many of the hospitals, in 3 years, they got more than 100% of their costs. Now, for certain of the hospitals in those 3 years, like Round Rock and Rio Grande, they didn't get 100% of their costs. So I was in the Court of Appeals, I was arguing to the panel, and I said, well, so does that mean it's okay if we don't have Medicaid in Rio Grande and Round Rock? Because obviously a hospital can't keep providing Medicaid if it's not getting paid its costs. But here's the real answer. The real answer is provided by the record. Mr. Reasonover and Mr. Lorenzen were the two top officials from the agency who testified. They both testified that the purpose of the prospective system is to set a rate going forward. The hospital knows what the rate is, and then the hospital has an incentive to reduce its costs so that it makes a profit. In fact, Mr. Lorenzen said, and this is at page 9 to 10 of volume 2 of the record, you get more than your cost if you're efficient. So, yes, the trial judge made findings that if you looked at these 3-year periods, some of the hospitals, in effect, got more than 100% of their costs. But that could have been because of efficiency, because that's the whole purpose of the system, is that they set the cost and then the hospital can make a profit by cutting its – I'm sorry, they set the reimbursement rate, and the hospital can make a profit going forward by being efficient and cutting its costs. And the agency wants us to do that because if we do that, the next time they rebase, the rates go down. So it's to our benefit to try to make the profit. It's to their benefit to get our costs down because our claims numbers will ultimately go down and it causes the reimbursement rate to go down. That's why the federal government adopted the Bourne Amendment for Medicaid and told all the states to go to a prospective system instead of a retroactive system, is so the hospitals would have an incentive to cut their costs. So here we come in this case, and the trial judge says, oh, well, you got more than 100% of your costs, so you're out of here. Well, that's what we were supposed to do. That's what we were trying to do. And so for all you know, on this record, the reason we got 100%, more than 100%, is because we were doing what we're supposed to do and being efficient.
Is it clear, is it based on a mathematical formula, that filling in those holes would impact the rates?
Mr. Reasonover testified twice, that if you fill in those holes, in other words, you add back in the big dollar claims, the standard dollar amount goes down. And so, yes, we know it impacts the rates. That's the answer to that. And I think I'm almost out of time, but, Your Honors, the appeals process, I've showed you how they handle it, and they say that my new claims, the ones they didn't process on time, they don't come in because they're not mechanical, mathematical, or data entry error. And I say, well, wait a minute. If I'm right about the right way to interpret the base year rule, and you should have counted my claim, but you didn't, the excluded claim, then it is a data entry error. So one of the things we're asking the court to do here on appeal is to say that we do have the right to go back and pursue those claims that we've already asserted for these prior years so that we can get our reimbursement rate for those prior years corrected and get the money that we weren't paid. So one of the issues here on appeal is whether we're right that the appeals process, as written in their own rules, if our interpretation of base year is correct, then we should be entitled to use that appeals process to get our claims corrected. And they've denied us that right. That's one of the issues on appeal.
Now, let me just make a quick question here. When you talk about the profit incentive,
yes, ma'am,
doesn't that sort of go against the language of the statute? Reasonable and adequate to meet the cost? There doesn't seem to be a profit.
It's interesting you say that, because if you read the federal statute language, instead of talking about reasonable and adequate to meet the cost of the hospital, meaning what particular hospital, talks about the reasonable and adequate to meet the cost of an efficient hospital. It is supposed to be enough to meet your costs, but it is the point of the prospective system is you know what that rate's going to be.
But if you come in under, isn't there a readjustment process where you can go back in and get some readjustment to make up for the loss?
You mean if my my rate is under what it should be? If my reimbursement rate is under what it should be?
Right.
Well, that's my problem here, Justice O'Neill.
No, not just your reimbursement rate, because I understand you're saying one of the reasons you lost was there was some profit that
right.
you made.
Well, at least that's one way to read those over 100% costs.
But if you came to the court and said, I've got a big gap here, is there not a readjustment mechanism in the statute that allows you to come back and show that on a hospital-by-hospital basis?
A big gap in my costs?
No.
I mean, my collection for my reimbursement?
A big gap if you're losing.
Yeah, I'm losing money.
You're losing money.
All right.
Is there not a way to readjust costs? There's no mechanism in the statute.
Okay, I don't have a mechanism under the statute to go to the agency and say, I'm losing money, you need to give me some more money, because that's not their problem. Whether I'm losing money is my problem, okay? But what I am entitled to from the agency is reasonable reimbursement.
Well, I guess that's my question.
Right.
Isn't there a way that if you can show what you're paying me is not reasonable and adequate to meet my costs,
that is the attempt to go back and compare it to our cost reports. And that's what the trial judge looked at. And he said, oh, well, based on the cost report, most of the hospitals, not all, but most of your 14 hospitals are getting their costs reimbursed. And so I'm not worried, okay? But I'm trying to explain that is a false way to look at it, because they may be getting more than 100% of their costs because they're doing what you're supposed to do. They're being efficient. And therefore, their costs are lowered, so the reimbursement rate shows that they're getting more than their costs. The reimbursement rate is like our revenue, and then our costs are our expenses. And so if I'm getting more than 100% of my costs, I'm making a profit. But I could be getting more than 100% of my costs, not because I'm getting the revenue I ought to get from the agency, but because I'm being really efficient and cutting my costs. And that's what I'm supposed to do under the whole prospective system. I'm only trying to make the point, Justice O'Neill, that the fact that they can show that for particular years a hospital might, under its cost reports, have gotten more than 100% of its cost does not mean that they're getting reasonable and adequate reimbursement under the agency's rules or to meet the statutory
rules. Are there further questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Kraft will present argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. In this case, the hospitals never tried to prove that their Medicaid reimbursements have not been reasonable and adequate to meet their costs. Indeed, the evidence shows otherwise. Instead, they've identified an internal agency practice that they think is costing them some money. That is the selection of the base year data on February 28th. And to get rid of that practice, they advanced tortured readings of the applicable rule and statute that would render that data selection invalid.
I don't know where these cutoff dates, what they mean, and because they can be arbitrarily any date, quite frankly. The problem seems to me that there are claims that are being paid for by the hospital, not recognized by your agency. And how do you address that?
The Swiss cheese model that she's using presumes that their interpretation of the rule is correct. And their interpretation is that this base year definition, that a base year is 12 consecutive months of claims data selected by the department, means this. We pick the base year, we pick one and only one criteria to associate with each claim, and that's it. That's the base, the green. And so anything else that we do to select this data that results in an admission not being included is a carve-out. But the rule doesn't plainly require that. You're not going to find this one and only one criteria in that rule.
Is there a carve-out for claims that appear to be significant and more cumbersome to process?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. And
how'd that come about? Their allegations are false?
Yes, there is no competent evidence to prove that the effect of the February 28th cutoff date is to disproportionately exclude high-dollar claims. Their only evidence of that is their expert, Ms. Nielsen. And her analysis is problematic in two respects. She didn't examine every claim that is affected by the February 28th cutoff date. And she didn't go through all the steps that the commission goes through in calculating rates. On this issue of disproportionately excluding high-dollar claims, she only looked at claims that the hospitals appealed, not at every claim affected by the February 28th cutoff date, only the ones they appealed. And there's evidence that shows that in some instances, not in every instance, but in some instances, the hospitals were cherry-picking claims that were affected by the February 28th cutoff date to appeal. The cutoff date has two effects here.
So you think the agency's position is if you extended the cutoff date, you'd actually pay less?
It's possible. We don't know. We don't know what the effect would be. There's no proof in the record of that.
So if the petitioners win, they could lose money and you could win money. That's kind of an odd posture for a case to be in.
But it happens that way because they did not prove what the effect would be. And
what is the effect of February 28th? Doesn't it cut off any reimbursement that's made for claims that are processed after that date?
There are two effects. That is one. If a claim is paid after February 28th.
You got an admission in your 12-month period.
Yes.
And that admission may be paid after the February 28th cutoff date.
Yes.
No question, then, that that's not included in.
That is not included. There is another effect. The other effect is that if a claim is retroactively denied, if after February 28th it's determined that it's not a Medicaid-eligible claim, we don't go back in and pull it out of the database. And there's evidence that the hospitals, when they were, in fact, most of these appeals dealt with not adding claims back in to the database. The majority of their appeals were to take claims out of the database. And there's evidence that in some instances, what they were doing is saying, I'm going to appeal to take a $1,000 claim out of the database, because that's a low-dollar claim.
But I thought Ms. Jace said that you don't allow appeals for these matters after February 28th.
We don't, but that was the basis of their expert's analysis. That was the basis of her analysis to show what the effect of the February 28th cutoff date was, and that is the only evidence they presented to show what the what type of claims would be excluded by the February 28th
cutoff. Okay, so you apply the February 28th date across the board to all the hospitals?
Yes.
Okay, so that applies to everybody, not just these hospitals.
That's correct.
And the effect of that is to exclude payments, no question, exclude some payments for admissions made during your 12-month period of time.
It means that they are not included in
that. Not included. And you have no process for allowing them to appeal and actually have them included.
That's right, but that's not required by the rule. The rule says it is a 12 consecutive month period of claims data selected by the department. The rule doesn't say anything about when we make that selection.
Okay, claims data or admissions data?
Claims data.
Okay, do you have 12 months worth of claims data that you are applying?
We do. Claims data means the charge that the hospital made for the patient admission and what was the diagnosis-related group. That's what you get out of claims data. So that's why we choose the admission date, because that you're trying to get what was the hospital's experience during this base year. And that's why you can't use paid claims, as Ms. Yates suggested, because if you say we're going to base it on paid claims, you're going to be picking up hospital's Medicaid experience from this prior year, prior to the base year that we've selected. You could have somebody admitted prior to September 1st, 1999, in this example, they go through their discharge and the claim is not paid until after that.
But what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that you're getting claims data from prior to September 1st, 1999.
Why isn't that effective in predicting what they will be in the future as well?
Because we're charged with getting 12 consecutive months of claims data of the hospital's cost experience. I mean, the claims data relates to what was the hospital doing.
Why isn't the paid cost the best analysis of the data?
It's not, because you could end up with 18 months of experience by the hospital, depending on when the claims was paid. When the claims were paid. Paid doesn't say anything about when the hospital was actually treating this person.
What does it matter? I mean, the bottom line is, what was the cost of the hospital? What's the reimbursement provided by the agency?
Because the rule directs us to get 12 months of claims data, so we need 12 months of the hospital's experience in treating people. And if we
sounds
if
like we, you're mixing American cheese with cheddar cheese here. It's not matching up.
Well, cheese we have doesn't have any holes.
Then why do the cutoff? Why do the February 28th cutoff? That flies against that argument, it seems to me.
The reason for that is this: the rule doesn't say when we select the data. So. By making the final data selection on February 28th, we are getting 100% of the claims data from that 12 consecutive month period that exists at that time. Now, at that time, there may be pending claims that have not been paid yet that will ultimately be paid, and so they're not selected. There may be pending claims that are not going to be paid.
But you can set the deadline on October the 1st. And your argument would be the same.
You could set the deadline on October 1st, but that is not the decision that the agency has made.
Well, clearly it's not, but it would have the same justification.
It would have the same justification, except that the goal here is to approximate, and this is the hospital's words, not mine, approximate the average cost for the hospital during the space year period. And that's why the rule doesn't say anything about when you take this step of finally selecting the database. There are two goals of the system. You've got one goal is to take some base period of data and from that extract an approximation of the hospital's average cost to treat an average Medicaid case. Then over here, you have this goal of setting a prospective rate by a particular deadline. These are going to be the final rates, and you're going to tell the hospital this is the rate regime you have going forward. What the commission has to decide is where in between those two time frames do we move from data collection to rate calculation. The rule doesn't say anything about when that happens. So the commission has decided internally we're going to move from the step of data collection to rate calculation in the middle.
But that's a fairly important determination. You say they make that determination internally, but it affects the bottom line.
Well, first of all, there's no competent evidence that it does affect the bottom line. And I want to address...
Well, whether it's higher, lower, I mean, stuff is left out that would affect the bottom line.
Well, we dispute that it's left out. It's not included because it wasn't claims data at the time.
But isn't that normally what rulemaking is for, so that they can make a record how it's going to affect the bottom line and argue it ought to be March 15th instead of February 28th?
But the standard for whether...
That is what rulemaking is for, so people can make a record and argue your agency acted unreasonably.
That is a goal of rulemaking. It is not required in this case because this is not a rule. The mere fact that the hospitals
are... It's not a suggestion.
The fact that they're saying it may cost them some money doesn't mean that it qualifies as a rule under the definition of the APA.
I'm willing to grant you that. We haven't had that fight. Maybe we haven't. We don't know. Let's assume we don't know whether they're going to be winners or losers. Why does that make it not a rule? It's a rule whether you win or lose, isn't it?
It's not a rule because the APA's definition of a rule requires that it be something that affects private rights. They do not have a right to have any quantum of data included in their reimbursement rate. What they are saying in their brief is it's a rule because it affects our pecuniary interests. But the APA doesn't say affects private interests. It says affects private rights.
Well, now, they have to treat these Medicaid patients in a lot of cases, do they not?
It is a voluntary program. Now, there are some public hospitals who, as part of their mission, say we're going to treat Medicaid patients, but it is a voluntary program. In fact,
they can turn them away if someone comes in the emergency room. They can turn them away if they say they're Medicaid.
They are not required to participate in the program.
My question was, can a hospital turn a Medicaid patient away out of the emergency room and say to the ambulance, take them 50 miles down the road?
They can say we don't treat a Medicaid eligible patient.
But we don't want them to do that. We want to make sure they get their reasonable and adequate costs.
That's correct. Do you agree that changing the reimbursement cut off will have a spillover effect impacting the hospital's array of care and services they provide outside of Medicaid?
Out to non-Medicaid eligible patients?
Right, that changing the reimbursement cutoff date will have a broader impact on the hospital's care for even those outside of Medicaid. The hospital budgeting.
Well, there's no proof of that in the record. There was no evidence put on of how this would affect their services to non-Medicaid eligible patients.
Mr. Kraft, I think you suggested that using an admissions basis for your 12 months of data is required by rule when you were asked why you couldn't use a claims paid basis. What's that rule?
It's not required. Well, it's indirectly required because the rule directs us to use claims data, and the purpose of the rule is to examine what the hospital's experience is in treating patients over this 12 months. Okay. If you pick this 12 months and you use the paid date, then you're not capturing what the hospital was treating and what their charges were over that 12-month period.
And identify the rule or the reg that you think directs you to do that.
The rule is subsection the definition of the base year says claims data, and there's not an express statement, but it is the gist of the rule is to calculate what the hospital's cost experience is during this period. And what would happen if you used this paid data is you're using claims and diagnoses from some other period, and you're having cost data from another period, and it's not matching up.
So it's not an express requirement in a rule. You think that the commission's approach is consistent with the purpose of this scheme that's set up?
It is, and because there is not a plain requirement to do it one way or the other, this is the Commission's reasonable interpretation of that rule. And so
what do you say about Administrative Code 355.063C, which directs the Department to use the overall arithmetic mean based year payment per case?
Yes.
Which is argued to be the Commission's requirement to determine average costs. Again, the language is arithmetic mean based year payment per case.
Yes.
Uses the word payment rather than admissions. What's the effect of that rule?
Because the base year payment per case is not what the hospital charged. The base year payment per case, as it is defined in the rule, is the hospital's average cost for treating its Medicaid patients divided by its case mix, which is an average of the relative weights for the various diseases that it treats. So, and you can't get that base year payment per case without using cost data and claims data. So it's not just what the hospital charged. We take a ratio of the hospital's costs for the year over their charges for the year, and then we say that's the ratio. That's going to be your cost ratio. So if your overall cost ratio is 50%, then we're going to take each claim, and we're going to take each charge that we include in the database and say your cost for that is 50% of that. Now, it might actually have been 80%, but because of the way the rule defines it, we're going to apply this cost-to-charge ratio and say, no, it's 50%. We average all those together and divide it by the case mix. So you can't just get it from the payment.
So if you take all of the claims made or the claims paid over a 12-month period, follow the process you're talking about, leave out none of the claims paid, you'll have your average that you're talking about.
you will have, the rule directs an average of the base year payment per case, but the commission selects the base year. The base year rule does not say anything about when we select that base year. That's what is left that to the commission by the rule, and that is the interpretation. It's not the court's role to say which of these various options should the commission be using. It's not to say what would we do differently if we were running the commission. The role is to say, is what the commission doing plainly inconsistent with the rule?
Well, our role is also to decide, can you just do this, or do you have to have notice and opportunity for hearing through rulemaking?
Yes, and you don't in this case, because this cutoff date does not qualify as a rule under the APA.
And that's because they don't have private interests, and that's because they're not going to lose any money, in your opinion.
Well, there's no competent proof of whether
if there were competent proof. You said a while ago that there's no evidence that the 228 cutoff disproportionately impacts high value claims, but if there were evidence of that, would your position be different?
No, it would be the same, because the APA does not say that anything that affects pecuniary interest has to be in a rule. And a good contrast.
But you told me that's what a rule was. So when's it not a rule?
The definition of a rule, or part of it, is something that affects private rights. Pecuniary interest is different from a private right.
How? And
because the hospitals do not have any right to have this particular set of data that they want included. They don't have a right to a specific...
Back to the assumption is that it has an effect on reasonable rates.
It has some effect, but they do not have a right to have that reasonable rate calculated using a specific quantum of data, and that is what they're arguing for.
But if the quantum of data results in them not getting reasonable and adequate cost reimbursement, why is that not a private right that's affected?
Because they haven't shown that it affects them.
Presuming they had.
But if they had shown that the application of this rule affects their right to a reasonable and adequate rate so that it's producing unreasonable rates, then you might say that affects their private right because they do have a right under the statute.
So then it begs the question, I suppose. You're looking at the merits of their claim to determine whether it's a rule, which seems backwards.
Well, they have not argued that. They have argued that reasonable and adequate requires this precise quantum of data. They have not admitted, which is what the federal authorities say, that this is just a zone.
Well, they say two things. They say it's a rule and you hadn't gone through rulemaking, but if you did, then they're going to have these objections to it. My question is, whether we should have the district judge decide this or your agency in an open, formal rulemaking and the third court look at it first?
Because if the court were to say that anything that affect that if you can show any change in your pecuniary interest that necessarily qualifies as a rule, it would vastly expand what has to be subjected to formal rulemaking that agencies have to do, and that would be a problem for our APA jurisprudence.
If this were determined to be a rule that had to go through the rulemaking procedures. Give me the parade of horribles. What would be wrong with that?
What would be wrong is that you would be saying that there are really two. One is that by merely showing some effect of pecuniary interests, that's enough. That any agency practice that moves your bottom line.
So it's the precedential value you're worried about.
That is one. The other is that it would belie the distinction between rules and interpretations of rules. We have this entire body of jurisprudence that says we interpret rules. This is how you deal with interpretations of rules. If every rule that affects somebody in some way is interpreted, then under their logic, that interpretation has to be put in a rule. And that's inconsistent with this distinction between rules and interpretations.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Ms. Chase, how does changing the cutoff affect the hospital's private rights?
exactly what I need to address, Your Honor. At tab 9 of our booklet, we have the formula for the, and this is, I'm confident counsel wouldn't dispute that this is an accurate representation of the formula. What he, when he said, when counsel says that we didn't prove that it reduces our rate, it, he's talking about their complaints about our expert, Julie Nielsen. Okay? I don't agree with his complaints, but I don't need Julie Nielsen. Lay Julie Nielsen aside, okay? I have undisputed testimony from Mr. Misner, M-I-S-N-E-R, who is the guy who's in charge at the independent agency, at the independent contractor insurance company that the agency uses to create the file, the claims data for the base year. And he says that it takes longer to process and pay the older, the bigger claims, and therefore the February 28th cutoff is going to mean that you lose the bigger claims. Disproportionately, the bigger claims are going to be paid after the cutoff. So I have that undisputed evidence. Then I have Mr. Reasonover, who's his head of the rate making at the agency, okay, who testifies not once but twice that the standard dollar amount, taking all things into account, including the case mix index, well, that's one of the arguments in their brief, but Mr. Reasonover says, including taking into account the case mix index, leaving out big dollar claims will have the effect overall, he says, that's the word he uses, of reducing the standard dollar amount. If you come down here, the reimbursement rate is a product of the standard dollar amount times the relative weight. That's the type of procedure that the hospital is doing. You know, is it a heart transplant? This, that's how you get to the reimbursement rate.
So private interest, the private interest prong of 2001-0036 is you're losing money.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean,
if
I do have.
If you prove you're losing money, it's a rule.
Well, I do have a private interest in that. My reimbursement rate is being affected. That's right.
Well, Mr. Kraft says private rights not the same as private interest.
Well, I mean, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, I have a private interest in, as a hospital providing Medicaid services, in getting the reasonable reimbursement rate that I'm entitled to under the statute.
Ms. Yates, that yes. seems to take me back to Justice Johnson's question yes. about the requirement or lack thereof for a hospital to treat an emergency room a Medicaid patient. It seems to me that under the analysis by the state that a hospital that chooses to do that does so at its own peril in terms of a business risk because there's a possibility that it won't be reimbursed for certain expenses.
Judge Medina, I'm told by my hospital experts that we don't have that option, that if somebody shows up in the emergency room, we got to treat them. Now, we can voluntarily decide to participate or not participate in the Medicaid program in general. That is voluntary. I will tell you that if you don't participate in Medicaid, you can't participate in Medicare either. So the hospital that makes a decision to cut itself out of Medicaid also can't do Medicare. So that's a big decision. So it's important to all the hospitals that they get paid correctly for their Medicaid services.
If you keep this structure, yes. sort of basic structure, but move the cutoff date a little bit or had a procedure to add some claims back in, or there's still going to be some judgment call, and at some point you got to say this is what we're going to do.
That's right.
And if that's massaged by the agency from time to time, every time they do that, does that require rules? A rulemaking? Hearing?
No, Your Honor, but I'm talking about a decision of the agency, the February 28 cutoff, that undisputedly has the effect of leaving out 3 to 5% of the claims. And I don't understand why counsel is telling you all that it doesn't have that effect. His own people testify that it has the effect of leaving out 3 to 5% of the claims.
Well, he just says he doesn't know whether it will go up or down.
But see, that's my point about the formula. His own guy says it goes down. So I don't think I've got that issue. But you're right, Your Honor, that unless you used 100% of paid claims, which they say in their brief they could have done. They just decided not to. They could have used 100% of paid claims. That's page 26 of their brief. But unless you do that, you are going to have a cutoff at some point. And as I said earlier, I'm not trying to say the court has to tell them exactly what to do, but they've got 18 more months in there. If they can get all but 3 to 5% with the six-month red period for 6 months, if you add 18 more months, you know, surely you'd get almost all of them, and certainly our rights would be more protected than we are now.
And if you get almost all, that's not all. So is there another suit?
That's true. That's true. And that's one of the arguments they've been making all along, that, you know, that there's no way for us to get completely 100%. But we do know that the cutoff has the effect of 3 to 5%, and we do know that there are options to get more than that.
What about the argument that using claims paid may take you back 18, 24 months and that does not give you a 12-month snapshot of the hospital's costs.
Right.
Because you go back beyond 12 months.
Right. And I suppose, Your Honor, that that's why they opted to go for the 12 months of admitted data. And that's certainly their, you know, their decision. And their, but when they do that, they've got to get 12 months of data. And they're not getting 12 months of admitted data because if they're not paid within the period, they don't get counted. So, I mean, I hear
so you don't care which approach they take so long as they include this 3-5% or as
right.
many of them as reasonably practical in the
right.
calculation.
We're trying to get to the point where we don't have an identifiable portion of claims left out and that are necessarily the big-dollar claims. That's the problem we've got with the February 28th cutoff and the way
the judgment, Chief Willis, your prayer is that this is an invalid rule that they've made, the 28th day, and also that you want the appeals process, some kind of an appeals process, either or. Is the question to us, regardless of the, whether it's an appeals process or whether it's the 28th cutoff date, is the question to us, is it a rule?
That's
and if
one,
so, is it an
that's
invalid
one,
rule?
Yes, Your Honor, that's one of the questions, and Judge Briscoe brought that up, and I didn't get to cover it, but yes, we think it's a rule, and they under the APA they should have adopted it. But most importantly to me, most importantly is their interpretation of the base year rule, contrary to the plain language of the base year rule, we say, their interpretation is violating their statutory mandate to because they're not following their own rules, which are supposed to be designed to get us to reasonable reimbursement.
So whether it's an appeal process you don't get or whether it's the 28th cutoff date, what you're telling us is it's an invalid rule measured by the statute,
there,
and that's what you want us to take
well,
care
that,
of.
That's the most important thing. But then we also would like to know or ask the court to tell us whether we're entitled to use the appeals process and whether or not it should have been treated as a rule for APA administrative purposes in promulgating that, too.
Further questions?
Thank you,
Counselor. The cause is submitted. And